Shana Tova, my Bobolas. Happy New Year to all. Welcome back. It is 5783. I learned that you can tell what year it is in the Hebrew calendar, or at least the last digit, because it aligns to the upcoming year in the Gregorian calendar. So it's going to be 2023. Therefore, the year number in the Hebrew calendar will end in 3. I didn't know there was that synchronization, but I just learned that. I was in services for the past couple of days at my synagogue. It was beautiful services, very, very nice. Nice sermons from the rabbis. It was interesting. Both rabbis in their sermons said that they intend to make Aliyah and move to Israel at some point in the future. That was news to me. I was surprised by that. But it was great to be there. I love being in synagogue. You know, I grew up going to the same synagogue, and when I was a kid going there, it was horrible. I mean, I saw it as a burden, and I did not enjoy going there. I went to Hebrew school for 7 years. I did not retain much. I don't even think I learned very much. The teachers were all these old, they were like survivors mostly with like the really thick ankles. I think I once mentioned on this podcast that one of my teachers, Mrs. Finkel, every time I was bored in class and I was picking my nose, she would stop class and look at me and go, "Do you need a tissue, dearie?" And then everyone would stop and look at me, and I was just terribly embarrassed, my finger deep in my nose. But I really did not get a lot out of Hebrew school. But now it's different. 15 years ago, they had a new rabbi take over, and he's young, and he's charismatic, and he has revamped the place. The main sanctuary of the synagogue sort of looks like a TV production studio now, because they have so many people who watch the live stream of services. There's a little bit of a weird thing where the synagogue raised money about 10-ish years ago. They did a huge capital campaign, and they raised a tremendous amount of money. Most of it came from Leon Black, the founder of Apollo. And the synagogue bought this townhouse and renovated the townhouse beautifully and made it so that that's where all of the Hebrew school classes are. They're now in this townhouse a couple blocks away, and it's named after Leon Black's father. And they did a big, you know, ribbon cutting ceremony, a huge, huge, beautiful renovation. And then the synagogue itself is two buildings. There's like the original building, which is the sanctuary. It's a beautiful old building from 100-something years ago. And then in 1980, they built another building right next door to it. And that building from 1980 was hideously ugly, terribly built. And the problem is it's been designated a landmark. So you cannot do anything to it. It is structurally too unsound to add floors on top of it, even though they have the rights to build more floors. But because it's a landmark, they can't tear it down and demolish it and build something newer and taller. So they're stuck with it. They renovated what they could on the inside, and they did a nice job with it. But all this money came from Leon Black, or most of it. And if you'll recall, Leon Black was implicated in the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking scandal. Remember that Jeffrey Epstein was presumably procuring underage people for sexual relations with his clients, with those he was blackmailing, either, both. And Leon Black paid Jeffrey Epstein like $140 million, and he said it was for estate planning services. Does that make sense to anybody? Like, you could hire all the world's greatest estate planning attorneys and having them on your full-time payroll for less than $140 million. I mean, it's just crazy, that idea that that was what he was paying for, estate planning services. Like, what a strange euphemism. So I have to think that a lot of the money has dried up now. And I'm glad they did the renovation when they did, but you can tell. I mean, that even just the way the administrators of the synagogue interact with people, it feels more like they're running a business, like every penny matters. And it did not used to feel that way. But services were great. I loved being there. I had an honor yesterday on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. I got to go up on the bima and hold up a Torah. It's called a hagba. When you hold the Torah so it can be dressed, they put the like band and the covering on the Torah. They're really heavy. It is hard to lift a Torah, but it was a great honor to be called up there to do it. And I was, you feel like a nice member of the community when you can do it. I brought with me, when I went to services, I brought my my talis in. I still have it in the bag that it came in from my bar mitzvah, but that bag is starting to break. And I noticed watching the show Shtissel that these Orthodox guys are always carrying a little plastic shopping bag. That's what they keep their tefillin in, just like a regular shopping bag. So I put my tallit bag into one of these reusable grocery bags, which, by the way, those are really a scam. It does not seem like that was an environmentally positive move to switch to these reusable grocery bags. It sort of feels to me like, I don't know, but it sort of feels to me like there's some like lobbying organization for the reusable bag providers of America, or maybe it's the supermarkets, or I don't know who. It feels like somebody lobbied for this and pretended it would be environmentally friendly, and I'm just not at all convinced that is true. These pile up, people throw them away. I can't imagine they're very biodegradable. I don't think this is like those the paper straws, which also felt very poorly thought out, and I doubt is making any environmental impact, and instead is just annoying people. It just doesn't feel like it was the right call here. I feel like we should probably talk about some serious stuff, like stuff that's going on in the world. In Italy, they elected a new prime minister over the weekend. And it seems like some people are upset about it. Some people are really happy about it. I don't know. I mean, she's supposedly pretty right wing. And I don't know if that's true or not. Her name is Giorgia Meloni. Supposedly pretty right wing because she's not into all the, you know, gender fusion stuff, and seems like she's advocating pro family, and I don't know. I mean, it seems as a result now that Twitter, there's lots, the usual suspects, the kind of, you know, fringe nuts on Twitter are all calling her fascist and talking about how it's a threat to democracy. Sort of interesting, this idea that someone could be elected in a free and fair election, literally the definition of democracy, a peaceful transfer of power in a free and fair election, and that somehow that is a threat to democracy. Literally, the essence of democracy is a threat to democracy. I don't know if I agree that that's possible. I mean, I get the idea that you could elect someone who is such a tyrant that while they are in office, they make changes to democratic processes such that there will not be a peaceful transfer of power after their term is complete. But otherwise, it's literally the essence of democracy. You may not agree with their policies, but it feels like there is a... maybe we're lacking in like a clear definition of what is fascism. What does that mean? It feels like we're maybe that word is getting overused. Now, Italy, I mean, Italy has not been very relevant to geopolitics for, I don't, like 2,000 years. So I'm not sure it truly matters. The country is sort of irrelevant. I mean, just because you know lots of people who have gone on vacation there, and so it feels somehow more immediate and closer than other places, I don't know that that makes it any more geopolitically relevant. And by the way, on the subject of geopolitics, she is pretty well aligned with American foreign policy. She is aligned with the foreign policy establishment on Ukraine and supporting Ukraine in the war with Russia. She is anti-Putin. In fact, she was right about Putin long before most others were right about Putin. She was anti-Putin when the rest of mainstream Italy was embracing Putin. She was right about China when the rest of mainstream Italy was embracing China. Remember that Italy is part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. Northern Italy in particular is economically very closely aligned with China. Why do you think COVID spread to Italy before it spread just about anywhere else, right? Milan... Rewind in your minds. Milan was like the first place that was hit because Milan had direct flights to Wuhan. Not many places in the world had direct flights to Wuhan. Milan did because Milan, northern Italy, is so closely aligned with China economically. And this woman, Giorgia Meloni, was right about China. So was I, by the way. But she was right about China when the rest of Italy was embracing China. And she seems pretty closely aligned on American policy. So I don't know if I would jump to labeling her a fascist. She was elected in a free and fair election in a country that doesn't really matter economically or geopolitically, but which is maybe punching above its weight a little bit. It's also interesting, you know, there's a free election and it's somehow a boost for fascism. Also, a woman was elected the prime minister of a country, and then you have all the usual knuckleheads coming out and saying that this is a threat to women. Why is it a threat to women, right? It's the same sort of paradox. Electing a woman as the leader of a country is a threat to women. Seems weird to me. I don't know that I really buy that. And I think, look, you know, I think if you looked at the Venn diagram of the folks who are in America who are worried about her election in Italy, it's like all the immunocompromised girls with long COVID and the giant foreheads. They're the same ones who are still masking, even though they're like 20 years old. That's who's most distressed about Giorgia Meloni calling it fascist and a threat to women. Is there a clear lineage? This is speculative. But is there a clear lineage that you can trace from the people who 30 years ago were like the typing teacher who said that they had carpal tunnel syndrome and wore that wrist brace. Can you trace a lineage from that lady to like the Lyme disease crowd and from there on to the long COVID crowd? Is that like the same person evolving over a 30-year period? I kind of think that's the same person, right? You never see the carpal tunnel people anymore. They've got a new made up thing. Maybe not made up. I don't know. Maybe some people really have it. The long COVID or whatever. I mean, it just seems nuts to me, but maybe, I don't know. But yeah, I think that's the group that is most upset about Georgia Maloney getting elected, which I don't know, maybe it'll be good. I'm not like close enough to Italian domestic politics to know, you know, one way or the other, but I've seen a few of her speeches. They did not seem crazy at all. Maybe I'm missing something, but they really did not seem crazy to me. Last week, I mentioned that I was watching this Jeffrey Dahmer show on Netflix. And it's good. I've watched a couple more episodes since then. He was an interesting serial killer. We haven't had one like him in a while. One, you know, a cannibal doing sex stuff, and he was a good one. And I raised a point last week that got a lot of feedback. So the point was, we don't have serial killers anymore. That's just fact. Like, they don't really exist anymore. Either because they get arrested before they can become serial killers, they're out. I mean, you know, whether it's because they get arrested because there's surveillance, everybody has a doorbell camera, cell phone tracking, whatever. So instead they become mass murderers, and we have a lot more of those and a lot fewer of the serial killers. That's number one. But number two was, I raised the question of, does the legal and wider availability of pornography of all stripes reduce the sort of pent-up feelings and repressed sexual desires that might have driven someone to become a serial killer? Because if you now have a legal outlet for whatever you are focused on, whatever you are fascinated by, maybe you don't need to go and recreate it yourself. Maybe there is another outlet for it now that did not exist previously. So maybe the wider availability of internet pornography has reduced the number of serial killers. Maybe not. Maybe that's just a speculative but not accurate hypothesis. This raised another question, which is, again, speculative. But what's the worst thing out there? I would say it's child pornography, also called CSAM, or child sex abuse material. That's the worst. I cannot make any sort of an argument why that is a good thing. That is an absolute, that is the worst thing out there. But let me ask a question. Is there some argument to be made that if you make some child sex abuse material legally available, let's say you have to register for it, but it's legally available, does that somehow reduce the amount of child molesting that is happening? Because there's now an available supply of this product. I mean, is that really different from the question of, if you legalize drugs, does that reduce the crimes that surrounded drugs because they were illegal? I think those questions echo in each other. Like, there's already CSAM that exists. So is there some argument to be made that if you give people access to it, that it reduces the urge to make more of it? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it's sort of a grotesque question. But if you believe that the availability of other material has reduced sexual violence in another format, and again, that's speculative. I don't know that it has. It's a question worth asking, I think. There was a book that came out about 20 years ago by Michel Houellebecq. Michel Houellebecq is a brilliant author. He's a French novelist who, his first most famous book was called The Elementary Particles. I remember when that came out. I think it was 1998, I want to say. And I thought it was brilliant. And then he wrote a few others that got him even more publicity. Elementary Particles was his most famous. But then, you know, his next novel was called Platform. And Platform is about a guy who goes to Thailand, amongst other things. It's about a guy who goes to Thailand on like a sex vacation. His father dies and he takes his inheritance and he goes and does sex tourism in Thailand. And, you know, there is rampant sex tourism in Thailand. And this book referenced that. This book references that there are Thai women who would be readily available for tourists who go there. And so, and eventually, by the way, the main character decides to move there permanently because they just love the bliss that he feels. You know, he just loves the feeling of being there. And I had a teacher in high school, Monsieur Dautre, French teacher, who everyone sort of perceived that he was a little lecherous in high school. There was only one woman, which is one is, you know, more than zero. I say only one, but there was one woman who he was sort of tied to, and there was a lot of speculation that he was having some sort of a relationship with this woman. But I don't know that it was ever proven. He just always seemed like a real creep. And it turns out Mr. Dautre moved to Thailand. I got to imagine he was sort of leaning into to his preferences here. Because later on, when like all of these prep schools, they did some investigation and found that there was indications that there were teachers who were doing naughty stuff with students a long time ago. He was one of the teachers who was implicated. And they were like, but there's nothing we can do about it. He lives in Thailand now and is a teacher in Thailand. Like, so I guess he really, you know, he followed the novel and leaned into it. There's those kids in the Thai cave I made that off-color joke about last week. There's another show about them as well. When it happened, and this was not covered in the movie about it, but when it happened, when those kids were stuck in the cave, I don't know if you remember, but Elon Musk sort of got involved and offered to build some kind of a submarine to get them out, which wasn't going to work, but he offered to, and then some guy who was on the ground in Thailand was like, that's not going to work, and Elon Musk called the guy a pedo. And I don't know if the implication was he's like a pedophile because he's trying to help these kids or because he's living in Thailand? Is the implication, if you meet a foreigner who has moved to Thailand, is there an implication that they are there for permanent sex tourism? It's possible. I don't know if that's the implication, but it doesn't strike me as totally far out, that idea. I wrote a piece last week about the federal funds rate, which got a lot of interest. I think my finest moment, I don't want to call it professionally, but like not personal moment, but my finest moment was when I was in high school. That was when I peaked. I was in high school. I was on our economics team that participated in this competition called the Fed Challenge, where your team of five people made a presentation about what the Federal Reserve should do with the Fed funds rate. And my junior year, it was very competitive to make this team. In my junior year, I made the team, and we made a presentation at the state level in Connecticut. And then we won there, and we moved on to the regional level in Boston, and we won there. And then we went on to the final round, at the national level in Washington, D.C. And we got to present in the Federal Reserve Board of Governors room to the actual governors of the Federal Reserve, including Alan Greenspan. It was a really cool experience. We got second place. I'm set. So now a quick primer on like what is the federal funds rate, because I know many of my listeners hear that term and don't necessarily know what it means. So if you are a bank in the United States and I go and deposit money, let's say I take $1,000 and I go and deposit it in the bank, the bank has to keep 10% of that on hand in case I want to go withdraw money or anyone else wants to go withdraw money. And the rest of the money can be loaned out. So the other 90% can be loaned out. So if I deposit $1,000, $900 can be loaned out. They loan the money to somebody who goes and buys a house or starts a business and buys stuff. And that creates a cycle, right? Because they go and buy stuff from someone for, say, $900 that they've borrowed. They buy stuff for $900. That person takes the $900, goes and deposits it in the bank. So now the bank has $1,900 in deposits. They can loan out 90% of the $900, so they can make another $810 in loans, and so on and so on. And so that's how banks work in the United States. Now, what happens if the bank gets to the end of the day and they realize, oh shit, we don't have the full 10% on hand? Well, they go to other banks and they say, hey, we're a little short of our daily reserve requirement. Can you loan us some money overnight? Banks have to have this money on hand at the end of every day. They have to have it overnight. So they go to other banks and they borrow money from those other banks. And the interest rate that they pay to other banks in order to borrow that money overnight is the federal funds rate. And the Federal Reserve creates a target for that rate and does things to try to influence it, called open market operations. For much of the past 15 years since the financial crisis, the federal funds rate has been 0%. That was the target rate, was 0%. So if a bank didn't have enough deposits on hand or enough reserves on hand at the end of the day, they could go to other banks to borrow, and the interest rate they would pay was 0%. And for 15 years, people said, that's too low, there's going to be crazy inflation, and there wasn't. And we've talked about the reasons why I believe there was not inflation for all of that time. But then, when COVID happened, we had this crazy panic, and the panic led to the lockdowns, and the lockdowns led to the stimulus spending, and the stimulus spending led to the inflation. And now here we are, and we have inflation, and there's a bill to pay. Now, how do you fight inflation? Well, one of the ways that we fight inflation is the Federal Reserve starts increasing the federal funds rate. Because if it's more expensive for banks to borrow overnight in order to meet their requirement, then they are less likely to lend out money. And if they're less likely to lend out money, then the economy starts to shrink. It's harder and harder to borrow money to buy a house, to start a business, to buy a car. The interest rate to do that becomes higher, and it becomes more difficult to do it. And so there's less activity and prices start to decline. Supply and demand adjust and prices start to decline. Usually we have a recession. I believe that we are in one now, and it is going to continue for quite some time. So you have a recession, that's bad. That's when the economy is contracting. Now, over the past year, the Federal Reserve woke up and they realized, oh, fuck, we have high inflation. We got to do something about this. And so they have been raising interest rates at a furious pace. A furious pace. And they have signaled that they are going to continue raising interest rates even further. Over just the past few months, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates by 300 basis points. That's 3%. That is so rapid. That's nuts how fast they're doing it. They just raised interest rates by 75 basis points last week. Usually they work in increments of about 25 basis points. Now, my mental model is telling me that it's enough. I think inflation has peaked. I think that prices are under control. I think these increases in interest rates are staggering. And the risk, as I've been saying for several months, the risk is to the downside. The greater risk is a severe recession. That scares me more than inflation at this point. Doesn't mean we didn't need interest rates to go up somewhat, but it's time for the Fed to stop. These interest rate increases take time to work through the economy. They take some time to have an impact on inflation. And right now we are looking at backwards-looking data. We're seeing data from last month where inflation was at, 8% or something annually and going, oh my God, we got to do something about it. But I'm more worried about next month. I'm worried about the future. And I think interest rates have risen fast enough and far enough that it is time for the Fed to pause. Because I really worry about a recession. That is my biggest concern. Now, if you believe that interest rates have peaked, if you believe maybe even that sooner than later they go in the opposite direction, that there's a recession and the Fed has to respond by reducing interest rates, then it is time to buy bonds. Mind you, this is not investment advice. I'm speculating here, but it seems to me like it is probably getting close to time to buy bonds. What bonds? Buy U.S. Treasury bonds. Buy U.S. corporate debt, AAA-rated corporate debt or something. I think rates will start to come back down. I'm speculating, and again, this is not investment advice, but it seems to me like that's probably the move now. I don't think equities have bottomed out. I think there is still room for more decline as the magnitude of this recession becomes clearer. I think stocks are going lower. And when I think it's time to buy stocks, I'll tell you. Again, not investment advice. Thanks, everyone, for joining today. Nice to be here with all of you. As always, remember that this is a listener-supported project, and I depend on your generosity. So please become a paid subscriber if you are not already one. But most importantly, just keep coming back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your attention. You can find plenty more content on the Substack, LeeBressler.substack.com, And we'll be back with more soon.